It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, we'll kick off the show with a special report from the January 30th national shutdown in response to ICE terror. I spoke with high school students, workers, and lawyers in downtown LA in front of City Hall, where thousands had gathered as part of my ongoing series, Rising Up in the Streets. Then we'll turn to filmmaker Ellen Gavin, whose new short film, The People United, has gone viral for depicting an ICE raid on an immigrant family that ends in neighbors standing up for one another. Finally, Terrence Keel, a professor of human biology and society, and African-American Studies at UCLA joins me to discuss his new book, The Coroner's Silence, Death Records and the Hidden Victims of Police Violence. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program, nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Hundreds of actions in all 50 states on Friday, January 30th, sent a message to the Trump administration against its deployment of ICE agents into American cities. The coordinated action was considered a national strike, encouraging students and workers to not attend school or work, to not shop or engage in any retail activity. Small business owners and nonprofit organizations shut down offices for the day and marched and protested. In Los Angeles, where ICE raids have become a near daily occurrence, thousands of people convened outside City Hall at 1 p.m., including high school students and union members. By 6 p.m., the protest ended in 8 arrests. I was at the gathering in the earlier part of the day and spoke with several people, including high school students, workers, and lawyers, about why they were on strike. And here is the latest edition of our series, Rising Up in the Streets.
Out, Trump, out!
Ice out, Trump, out!
Ice out, Trump, out!
Ice out, Trump, out!
My name is Wolfgang Gegenhuber. You can call me Wolfie G or whatever you like. 16, proud to be 16, and I'm a proud supporter of hating ICE and hating Trump in any way.
You're supposed to be at school today, but you're not?
Yeah, who wouldn't not skip this? This is incredible. And absolutely, it is necessary that we skip school to go do this. No work, no school, no shopping. You just got to do it. I go to school at LOXA. It's LA County High School for the Arts. It is an incredible performing arts school. They have directing, theater, music.
Yeah, and it's public school.
Yes, it is. And it's a great public school. And obviously, rest in peace, Renee Good. Rest in peace, Alice Peretti, and everybody else. It is truly a shame and a tragedy what Trump and ICE have done to this country. And I really do feel that I hope that ICE and Trump get what they deserve 100%. I want Trump and ICE gone. If they can't get it, then we'll just throw them out ourselves. Because we will never stand for this oppression and fascism that Trump has put us under. For so many years, from 2016 to the first time in his presidency, to the second now, he has caused nothing but trouble and grief for every one of us. And we will do whatever it takes to stop him and get him out.
My name's Ashley. I'm 17 and I go to Almani High School.
Why are you here today?
To support my parents because they came here illegally for a better opportunity, find a new job, and to support my sister also, who's an immigrant. So I'm here to support them. My mom is from Mexico and my dad's from Dominican Republic. My cousin, she got deported by ICE recently, so I'm here to support her too because it's a really tough situation, deporting people who come in for better opportunities and for a better lifestyle. And you know, ICE stops them for no reason.
How has your family coped with your family member being taken?
They have not gotten out of the house due to it. We set up a GoFundMe page for her. Gladly, all the money is raised, so hopefully she could come back. But in all due right now, they don't want to come out due to ICE being in our city right now. So they're like all over the place.
Are you seeing what's happening in the rest of the country? I imagine you must be reading about what's happening in Minneapolis too.
Yeah, I've been seeing it recently, and it really got me mad about what they did to Alex. So I came here to support my parents and everybody that's all immigrants.
And do you think that this is not new though, right? Like, no. This is just worse.
Yeah, it's just my first time protesting here, so hopefully there's more protests so to help everybody like come out and support each one of us.
What do you want for the future of your family and of this country?
For ICE to stop deporting people. Because they come here, they want to like enjoy a new life. They want to come here for peace and everything. And I hope maybe one day Trump's out of here and if we get a different president.
And a president who would do what exactly? What advice would you give a future president after Trump?
Don't be hanging out with minors. What people don't know is that Trump was in Epstein's Island with minors, having a minor on his lap. That's what we hope that the president doesn't have if we have a new one.
So pretty low standards.
Yeah, pretty low standards.
Don't be a pedophile.
Yeah, don't be a pedophile. That's all. Don't be a pedophile. Don't raise inflation, because now inflation is crazy. That now you have 40 people being all gone, and then water bottles too because of the snowstorm too. So like they're coming up for no reason.
What do you want to do when you are older? Do you have any hopes, plans, dreams for your future?
Hopefully in the new future, I can help my parents get a green card. Once I turn 21, get them a green card so that way nothing happens and they'll be all safe. Hopefully be a criminologist so that way I study and everything like that. If that doesn't work out, then probably be a nurse.
Ice out! Trump out!
Ice out! Trump out!
Ice out! Trump out!
Hi, my name is Odell Ornelas. I'm from Warren High School and I'm 17.
And you're supposed to be at school today. Why are you here in front of City Hall?
Well, I think it's just important to speak out. Being here in itself is very powerful, and all these people, students, just being here and be able to speak out against what's happening is important.
And what has motivated you? What are you most upset about happening in the country right now?
I think just the divide. People are just being angry, and they're able to sit on their phones, and like I think just being here is really important and for what's going on.
What do you want to do for your future, and what do you want for the future of your country?
I want to personally be an engineer, and I want that space to be equally diverse and have equal opportunity to grow.
Thank you so much.
My name is Maya. I'm here today because I've had enough. Like, this is, we need to demonstrate that we're over this. We need to protect our people.
What do you do?
I actually work in retail right now, so okay. I called out today because I needed to be here. I couldn't pretend we were okay anymore.
So you're on strike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you articulate what angers you most about what you're seeing in the country right now?
Kind of this desensitization to it all, and just the fact that no mainstream media ever talks about this, about what we're going through, what's actually happening. Like, a lot of media overseas have like shown what's really going on with ICE and with our neighbors, and especially those in Minneapolis. So,
and what would you want them to cover? Like, what would ideal coverage be? What should they show?
They should be out in the communities and just showing what's actually happening, reporting what's happening, and not just doing what's the big news of the day. Like, let's not go, we're gonna cover it up with something else. Like, that's what I've been noticing a lot with mainstream media, is that they cover it with something different, something that's like, I don't know, important to, you know, your stock exchange or whatever, but it's actually being on the streets with the people and talking to the people themselves.
Do you feel unsafe as a brown woman in America?
Oh, definitely. Like, it's hard to go to work sometimes because it's hard to pretend that the community that I have to work with, as far as like what I do as a job, it's like they don't actually care what's happening. There's no real like awareness to it. And so it's hard to pretend that like I can't to walk into a space and expect maybe they may call somebody.
Have you been impacted by the ICE raids or know anybody who has?
I know a few people who have been, but I have not immediately been impacted by it. But I know that the family I live with right now, they are at risk. If anything were to happen, they would be at risk.
What do you want for the next couple of years? We've only finished the first year of the Trump regime.
God, only the first year. God, I only hope that something is done about these ICE raids, about the tyranny that he's causing on our people, on the people of the U.S. It's just ridiculous. It's almost surreal that this is what our life is.
I'm Susan Agra. I'm with the Immigrant Defenders Law Center. We're a few blocks from here, and so obviously we had to be here.
I'm Kimberly Harbin, also with the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, and I represent clients who've been detained, so that's why I'm here.
How severe is the problem in LA? All eyes are on Minneapolis right now, but they came to LA last year, right?
They came to LA like yesterday. You know, Boyle yeah. Heights was blowing up, all that area, Lincoln Heights, El Sereno. One of our coworkers was like in tears because she had just witnessed people being picked up as she was, you know, getting ready to go to work. So it has not let up whatsoever in LA. But as media sometimes can be, you kind of chase the most dramatic. Not that Minneapolis doesn't deserve the attention that it's getting. It absolutely does. But it's business as usual here in terms of ICE activity.
Yeah, I agree. They're still here. You just don't hear about them as much, but there are a lot of people who are afraid to leave their houses because ICE is down the corner. The person that she was talking about yesterday, her child also saw someone being detained, and she has to explain what happened there. And this is something that affects, like, all of us, citizens, non-citizens. We all have family members. We all know people who are afraid to leave their homes.
Do you think a walkout like what's happening today can have an impact? You know, can this make a difference?
I think it is making a difference. I would love to see this happen regularly, like we see in other countries where people every single Friday, they're out there protesting. I'd love it if something like that happened here. But I think this matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because this is part of a nationwide effort. And it really, I think, came, you know, the inspiration from folks who've been resisting, just everyday folks who've never participated in anything, have started coming out. And so we want to be part of that national, you know, move to present. We're ready to try every tool we can to push back on what's happening.
You know, people, I think, don't realize how important legal defense is. And since both of you work at the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, that invisible work of legal defense, how critical is it? And what do you want folks to know? There's a lot of young people out here who might be considering someday becoming lawyers.
It makes a big difference. Without a lawyer, you get detained. You might sign paperwork you don't understand, and that means you get deported the next day. For those who have attorneys and have access to attorneys, they know that they're not going to sign anything, and they know that someone is working to actually try to get them out of detention so they can get back to their families. So I think if young people want to do this, this is really important work. We need it on the direct service, like you're actually helping client side. We need it on the policy side. We need it on the advocacy side.
People get picked up on the street, and then it's just the beginning of their journey, and that's where we come in. You know, there's so many aspects to this fight and to this struggle. This is just one piece of it, but it's very direct. It's very, you know, individualized and a personal, just standing by them and walking them through this process. It's hard right now because we don't win very often, but when you do, it has such a powerful impact. And the repercussions, the ripple effect is just endless. And it's now very direct, very direct.
A lot of folks have been saying, Obama deported many more millions of immigrants than Trump. And the two of you probably have information and knowledge about that and opinions. How do you counter that? Like, why are you complaining? Obama deported so many more people.
So we complained during the Obama administration about the deportations that were happening.
Deporter in chief.
Yes. So, you know, we're not that tied to parties. It really just matters what they're doing. Also, there is a huge difference in the manner in which arrests and deportations are happening now. Huge, huge difference. Never before seen the brutality and indiscriminate nature of this. You know, just a racial profiling, you know, kids. I mean, everybody knows the stories. And that is not been seen before by anyone.
Yeah, I agree. And people were very busy during Obama's time. They were busy during Biden's time. This is different in that it seems more malicious. And the purpose is to just sow fear in entire communities, entire cities. And yeah.
It seems like it used to matter during Obama and Biden's time if people had some legal status and had papers. And now that doesn't seem to matter.
Well, they're telling people that their status is no longer valid, and then they can go pick people up. So that kind of expands the pool of people that you can terrorize with these types of raids.
What's your hope for the future? There's a lot of, as I said, a lot of young folks out here who have walked out today. You two are more seasoned, and you have maybe more information than they do. What advice would you give a young person who's walked out of school today about the future?
I think everything everything takes time. You don't give up, you wait it out, you fight with the battles that you can, but nothing is going to last forever. We're not going to be in this situation forever, and we're going to do the hard work that we can until things change, and we'll still be there doing the work.
Yeah, we still need to speak up. That's, you know, so their engagement, them walking out, them participating in events like this is important. It's also important to just show community, be together, you know, show compassion, lending a hand to individuals. It's a time to really build the love in the community to get us through this together, because it is undoubtedly a very difficult time, and it's probably going to get worse. So we need to just hang in there together and care for each other.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Can you give out the website for Immigrant Defenders Law Center?
www.imdef.org.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And that's a special report from downtown Los Angeles in front of City Hall, where thousands of people gathered for a national strike on Friday, January 30th. And it's the latest edition in our ongoing series, Rising Up in the Streets. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. As the Trump administration continues to terrorize American cities with ICE agents in places like Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Chicago, and elsewhere, local organizers have come up with innovative and creative ways to defend themselves. From rapid response networks to documentation of ICE arrests, people have been showing up for their neighbors and communities. A new short movie by filmmaker Ellen Gavin depicts the importance of solidarity against ICE raids. It's called The People United, and Ellen Gavin now joins me. She's a writer and director living in Los Angeles and New York. Her theater and film work is female-driven and socially conscious, born from her experiences as a passionate lesbian feminist activist. She's written and produced 5 digital short films as part of the anti-Trump resistance movement in the United States. Welcome to the program, Ellen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So this very short film, The People United, it's not a documentary. It is a fictional depiction of basically an ICE raid. How do you describe it to audiences?
Well, it's interesting because I, you know, as a writer, I mull over things and I look at situations and try to figure out, you know, what needs to be said when. And it felt when I started this process that getting neighbors to understand that we need to be responsible for each other and that we can stand up together because we have greater numbers than they do. So I wanted to come up with something that, as a dramatic writer, in a short form, where you could really touch people's hearts. And my theory with that is that you touch people's hearts in order to move their feet, right? So getting people to understand that if we have a neighborly response, if we have a response that's based in kindness and activism, that we can actually impact the direction of this country. So many different things come into it. It's a fascinating process. I had a friend who was managing a bathroom renovation, and she got a call from the project manager. And while she was talking to him, she heard this glass shatter, which was her bathroom, her new bathroom door. And I heard that story, and it was ICE that was taking the worker. And I thought, wow, you know, that's Kristallnacht. That's what happened in Germany. And so that kind of made its way into the script. So little pieces of things like that, the Japanese internment, which is so relevant. I wanted to bring that in. Los Angeles is such a wonderful community, and you can literally live in any neighborhood and encounter every age, every ethnicity, every history. So that was another point of it, which was just to say that by getting involved in activism, you meet your neighbors. You know, you trust your neighbors, you come to protect your neighbors. So it got a great reception. It's reached millions of people and hopefully inspire people to take action.
And so the film is set in Los Angeles. And for our audiences, I'll play a short clip of the very short film. It's just something like 3.5 minutes long. But just to give my audience a taste of it, here's a short clip of the film, The People United, by my guest, Ellen Gavin.
Don't say another word, friends. You got a warrant signed by a judge? Let's see it.
National emergency. No warrant required.
That's exactly what they said to me when they interned me in the desert hellhole in 1942. It's un-American.
I survived Palau. Rule 916 of the military code, you are not obliged to follow an illegal order.
Come in. All right, men, you're all done here.
Let's go.
And that is an excerpt of a short film by my guest, Ellen Gavin, called The People United. It's set in Los Angeles and kind of reenacts, I suppose, a scenario that has played out in countless neighborhoods, not just in LA and in many other parts of the country as well. There's a surprise guest at the ending. I don't know if I should ruin it, if that's something that you think is a draw and you want to tell us. But there's at least one very high-profile guest in this film.
Absolutely. Dolores Huerta is a dear friend and collaborator. And I called her and told her about the project. And she drove hours to be there and walked right on set. It was such a delight for the actors in this film and also all the community extras. The people that you'll see in the film are all folks from Los Angeles that are doing this kind of work.
Dolores decided she wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah, she stepped in and I just directed her in the moment and we came up with the chants and I go to a lot of demonstrations myself, so I had been collecting my favorite posters and sayings and chants, and so I brought all those to it, and she, of course, Si Se Puede is a great rallying cry that she created when she formed the UFW. Dolores is a phenomenal, 70, 80 year activist. She's 95. She's been at it since she was at Girl Scout. And she's leading, and she and I are hopefully going to collaborate on another one, because we go back and forth and talk about what's needed, what's necessary in the moment. And she's fighting in her area, the Central Coast of the Central Valley of California. She's there watching them. They're building they have a new facility in California City, which is housing folks. And she's all over the country with a schedule like you would not believe. So Dolores is in it for the long haul. She's the true leader. I mean, she's someone who we have the great honor of having in our lives, because she is literally Martin Luther King, just phenomenal. And always, the interviews that I've done with her, she knows her history. She knows everything. She can tell you every person, every martyr during the UFW strike, the name, the age, how they died, because people died in that struggle as well. So, Dolores is able to bring, and also she talks about the waves, when they want the workers here to build the railroads or to farm the, vegetables or to do the construction, they bring in immigrants, and then when they want to get rid of you and they want to have a kind of terrorizing activity like we have now, then it's, the Chinese Exclusion Act and the wetbacks and just horrible, horrible waves of taking in immigrants and then tossing them away when they're done. So she's lived this and knows the history in her bones.
Yeah. Tell me, so the film starts out showing a family that is just part of the Los Angeles neighborhood. And then you have, as ICE agents show up, you have neighbors who receive ICE alerts on their phones. And this is a real thing that's happening, right? There are rapid response networks that have been set up locally all over the country, where people are keeping tabs on the movements, whenever ICE is sighted, and then are showing up in different ways. And in this particular scenario that you wrote in your film, they show up on the doorstep of their neighbor as ICE agents are there. Is this something that was based on something that you personally witnessed or read about?
Well, again, I go ahead and I do my research, and I plugged into, as we all are these days, to what's happening in the networks and what's happening. So the ICE applications I have on my phone, an ICE application, ICE Alert. You know, as this video has progressed, I'm now studying up for the next one, and now I'm understanding how they are tracking facial recognition, cell phones they have. Now ICE and the whole network of enforcers have drones where they're tracking our cell phone usage. I mean, we're in a really serious time. So, you know, and I'm actually thrilled by the responses that neighbors have come up with. The singing in front of at hotels where ICE agents are being housed, the whistles being blown. It's a simple, you know, idea that you start interrupting these assaults from ICE and you can gather your neighbors. So I think we have to be prepared for anything and everything. And my next video is going to focus on the money, because what you have right now are two companies, CoreCivic and Geo Group, who are splitting about $8 billion a year. And they are getting $200 a night for 100,000 beds. They're building new facilities. They are developing ancillary businesses, like they charge for phone calls. They are doing the tracking. They are doing transport. So they're developing. Once you build an industry like this, once you build these detention camps, they're not going to go away. They're going to be filled. And who are they going to be filled with? So we are literally watching the creation of a police state. So, yes, I take in information. I take in stories from people. I watch a lot of news. I particularly, you know, watch the activists in the community, because that's who's inspiring me.
Let me ask you finally about the narrative impact of such films. What is this particular film, The People United, the other film you were just describing, that your future project sounds amazing as well, but just sticking to The People United, and as you mentioned, it's gotten many, many views online. Is the idea to inspire people that they can indeed do this? Because although there are people showing up for their neighbors, there probably are some people who maybe are on the fence or, you know, wanting to show up but aren't quite there yet or don't feel capable yet of taking that, what might feel to them a very political position. Was it meant to inspire people to see this, you know, this is what it looks like?
Precisely. You know, since this came out, and it has received millions of views, we've had two murders, at least, you know, and not to mention the people who have died in ICE custody. But so it's frightening to think about getting involved when you see people, you know, like Renee and Alex, who died, when you see them, you know, murdered in the streets, you are taking a risk. But we don't have a choice. We don't have a choice. I mean, otherwise we're going to lose our country and lose our freedom, all of us. So what I love about the People United is people watch it and they get tears in their eyes. I mean, I literally, myself, I made it, I wrote it, I directed it, and I get tears in my eyes. Yeah. And partly what I was working towards there, and it's an interesting story about using this land as your land, this land is my land, which, you know, Woody Guthrie's song, which started as a black, the actual beginning of it was a black spiritual that he took. I had to contact the family because there's still a copyright on that song, believe it or not, even though it's more than 100 years old. They kept the copyright because they did not want to see it in Donald Trump's playlist, you know.
I see.
NRA wanted to use it at one point, and they said no. So I had to call and speak with the daughter of Woody Guthrie, and she was wonderful, and asked for permission. And then at the end, instead of saying this land belongs to you and me, which I think we all know we're on native land, I changed that line to we shall not be moved. But I love that, you know, we all relate as Americans to a song like that, and we feel the pride, the unity, the solidarity, when we feel the good parts of this country, when we feel the brotherhood and sisterhood of this country. So I think that touches people. Right. And then to hear Dolores, who simply came on set, and you see that in this video. I hope everyone who hasn't seen it sees the video. She just, from her heart, speaks, you know, and just commands the presence of that crowd. And you know, once you see one person act, I mean, that's what's so beautiful. I mean, I didn't even realize when I wrote it, I didn't realize until I produced it, that I had four women over 90 in that video. African, the Latina grandmother, the Japanese survivor, Dolores herself, and then I also had a veteran and the Holocaust survivor. And there's a resonance with the tattoos on the arm of the woman who comes to also demonstrate. And meanwhile, the Mexican American man has been you know, interrogated about his tattoos, which is ridiculous. I mean, literally putting people in jail because they feel like they have the wrong tattoos. But I didn't realize that I put literally five seniors, including the veteran, five people in their 90s in the film. And so what
and,
is
and
that?
You mentioned earlier that some of these are folks, I mean, I'm assuming these are not necessarily professional actors. You worked with people who are actors.
The core people were professional actors. They just won, by the way, they just won an ensemble award from the San Francisco Art House Festival, which is really sweet.
As the court, meaning the ICE agents, the people who play the ICE agents,
those,
and the people who play the
professionals. Yeah. Everyone outside who is hearing and singing.
The neighbors who show up are community activists who you reached out to?
Community activists, and the redheaded woman with the sign, she was an associate producer, a line producer, and she jumped in and just grabbed a sign, and she also brought in a lot of, Natalia brought in a lot of extras, Estrada is her last name. And what was really beautiful too is the music, the man who composed the music that brought This Land Is Your Land fully through was a Greek green card holder. Sev, the cinematographer, lost both her mother and her sister in Kosovo. She is, also a green card holder. A lot of people, immigrants, Russian, a lot of folks that worked on this were green card holders.
Well, Elena, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll certainly share a link to the full film with our audiences as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Ellen Gavin. She's a writer and director living in Los Angeles and New York. Her theater and film work is female-driven and socially conscious, born from her experiences as a passionate lesbian feminist activist. We've been talking about her new short film called The People United. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations and free speech TV and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. 5 years after the record-breaking racial justice protests around the United States in response to the police murder of George Floyd, law enforcement continues to kill more than 1,000 people a year nationwide. Now, a new book reveals how coroners and other death investigators help cover up police injustices and are effectively complicit. Terrence Keel is a professor of human biology and society and African American studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, and he now joins me to discuss his new book, The Coroner's Silence, Death Records and the Hidden Victims of Police Violence. Welcome to the program, Terrence Keel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So when we think about the issue of police violence, we often picture, you know, the horrific things that happen to men like Eric Garner or George Floyd. But maybe we don't think about the things that happen that are not within our view, that aren't captured by cameras. And we certainly don't necessarily think about what happens when people are in police custody, in jails in particular, meaning they're, you know, they haven't even been charged or convicted often. Tell me what pulled you into writing this book that really tells a story, I think, that is an undercovered aspect of police violence.
You know, Sonali, there were really two things that started all of this work for me. One was witnessing the public murder of George Floyd. And really, if we remember that moment, yes, it was a recorded death. And the medical examiner of Hennepin County wrote that it was a homicide. But what was particularly troubling about his death record was an effort to say that his heart was the real cause for why he died. And if you might recall, the top line in the autopsy was cardiopulmonary arrest complicating law enforcement subdual. Essentially, George Floyd had a bad heart. Because he had a bad heart, police had to use more force. And that force was ultimately what took his life. And I remember reading that and watching the reaction around the world. And it occurred to me, how many more records are written like this? How many more cases are there where people die in police custody, either during arrest or during jail or in jail? And the death investigator blames the victim and uses their own pre-existing condition or their body to really explain what happened.
Right. So in that particular case you were describing, the, you know, Derek Chauvin, the man who was ultimately convicted of murdering George Floyd, was the primary perpetrator. But you suggested the person who wrote the death report was in some way an accomplice, would you say?
They wrote the death report in such a way that actually aided the defense for Derek Chauvin. Later, you know, if we remember the trial, the attorneys for Chauvin really tried to lean in on this idea that George Floyd had fentanyl in his system. He had an enlarged heart. He was a carrier of sickle cell trait. All of these things to say that it wasn't the actions of police that took his life. It was actually his own body.
So how many such cases are there? How prevalent is it that coroners help to cover up police-perpetrated violence, killings, and death of people who are in police custody, whether it's out in the open, during an arrest, whether it is behind closed doors, off, you know, in jails? How widespread is this practice of writing death reports in ways that obscure, if not actively aid, obscure police perpetration or actually aid them?
It's a great question. You know, the way that I like to think about it is, you know, if you want to know how often this is happening, what we first need is a data reporting system that really allows for the public to see all of the records and all of the cases of people who die in custody. But when we look at state laws, there are no uniform laws around who can actually see a death record and who can't. So across the 50 states, each state does this differently. And there are certain states like New York, for example, where if someone dies in police custody or in jail, the public will never see those records. Those records aren't part of the public record. But in a state like California, for example, you can see those records. So that's the first thing to think about. The second is that, you know, when we piece together in my lab just the victims who died during arrest, this doesn't include people in jail or in prisons or in carceral institutions, just arrest deaths. Between 2000 and 2020, there were 32,104 people who died during arrest in the United States. So these are people who died before going in front of a judge, before having a trial. They died outside of the formal legal system. And what we can say is that we will never fully know about all the cases about people dying in custody, because the government at the federal level has not really given us much leadership on this issue. We've kind of been existing as a nation where we really haven't cared to count the people who police kill.
Wow. I mean, those numbers do shock me as well. It's quite remarkable. Let's talk about the research you did for this book. You say that you spent a lot of time with the dead and their loved ones. What went into putting together this comprehensive, it seems, look at an undercovered aspect of police violence? What did you have to do?
Well, it required a great number of things. One, I first started working with impacted families and communities. I started working with a woman named Helen Jones, who lost her son, John Horton III, on March 30th, 2009, inside of Men's Central Jail in downtown Los Angeles. And through working with her, I really learned how this system fails us and where it was broken. And through her wisdom and her experiences working with other impacted families, I began to sort of understand how to read a death record against the archival grain. You know, without the wisdom of Helen Jones and so many other impacted families, it wouldn't be possible to do the work that I did and the work we did together in my lab. But to write the book, I looked at about 1,000 autopsy records from around the country. So not just in California, but across all 50 states, to kind of get a sense of just the scale and scope of this crisis. And one thing that was really clear is that every demographic in America is at risk of losing their lives in police custody, because we find all demographics in this death ledger.
Wow. Because this is a solutions-oriented show, I want to talk about what we do about it. I think many in our audience are well aware that police is not the solution to public safety. And that there are, you know, things that we can do to keep ourselves safe, that make police obsolete. But while we live with this system of policing, what can be done specifically about the complicity of coroners? And maybe the path to that answer lies with the question of, why do they even do it? Why do coroners do what they do? Why do they feel the need to defend police? And what can be done about holding them accountable?
These are all great questions, and there's you know, dimensions to answering and solving this problem. If we want to think about the medical examiners and coroners, which, you know, the criminal justice reform movement, we've not been giving a lot of attention to them. We should. One of the first things I think that can be done is sort of legislative changes, and there are things that we should be doing that would make a great deal of change. So, for example, in most states in the United States, a autopsy is not mandatory after someone dies in police custody. The only states that mandate an autopsy following an actual death in custody are Illinois, Mississippi, Nevada, South Carolina, Virginia, and Wisconsin. The other 43 states don't make an autopsy mandatory, and Arizona and Wyoming don't do it either. And so what that tells us is that there needs to be some legislative changes to ensure that death investigators are actually conducting a full study when we lose our lives in police custody. The second thing that I do talk about in the book is that there was a period of time where the coroner was a democratic institution, meaning it was directly accountable to local residents and people who hold power. Since modernization during the 20th century, medical examiners don't really run for office any longer. They're appointed by local government, so they're not directly accountable to a voting constituency. I think that there is some real progress that could be made if we could start converting the medical examiner and death investigators into an elected office that requires people to be held accountable to voters, and for the public to be, I think, embedded into this system of death investigation. Your larger question, I think, is how do we stop people dying in police custody? How do we create safe cities, safe streets, safe towns? That starts by just addressing people's most basic material needs. One of the most shocking things I learned writing this book is that a great number of people who died in police custody had already been failed by local, state, and federal government. These were people who were unhoused, often underemployed or unemployed, who were suffering the substance abuse issues, who didn't have access to healthcare, and they found themselves ensnared in this sort of trap where we use police to kind of pick up the pieces of our vanishing social safety net. So I think that's what we need. We need a robust social safety net if we want to make sure that people don't end up in police custody and potentially losing their lives.
And that is the abolitionist ideal, right? Putting money into the things that keep us safe, like a social safety net, and taking money out of policing because police budgets suck up so many of our resources and don't actually keep us safe. They're simply there to enforce violence and to hurt us. And there's so many other things we could do to stay safe. But staying on this issue of coroners, another thing that I think is so seems to be undercovered is the depth of the human tragedy at stake here and the fact that it's still not heard enough, right? 2020 was a high point for national awareness of police violence, particularly as it impacts Black and Brown communities. And then we saw such a backsliding. What are some of the storytelling, what is some of the storytelling work that you think needs to be done to highlight just how violent police custody is, and also specifically coroner's complicity? Any short stories that you can share with us?
Sure. You know, you're putting your finger on something that I think is really important, and that is this book is coming out in the moment to remind us of the values and the commitments to criminal justice reform that we saw in 2020. Remember, the George Floyd protests were the largest global protests in modern history. Mm. And so that energy, that commitment to change needs to be summoned again. And my hope is that this book will sort of tap into that sensibility to remind us that this is a system that is dangerous and it shortens people's lives and it threatens us all. I think one thing that I think we can do a bit differently is to sort of remind the world and remind Americans, people in this nation, that this is a system, it does target Black men and Latino men. They are disproportionately the targets of police violence, but they're not the only ones. And when we looked at just the number of people who die over that 20-year period, the largest demographic in terms of raw numbers were white men. White men are being killed in police custody at some of the highest numbers, even though Black men and Latino men are overrepresented given how small they are of the population's eyes.
Right. So relative to the population, there's yes. overrepresentation of Black and brown people. They're, right. they're more likely, if you're a person of color, you're more likely to be targeted. But yes. in sheer numbers, because whites are still the majority, the number of whites is the yes. largest. And that also goes for things like, you know, welfare recipients, right? Which people don't think
Absolutely.
About. Yeah.
I think we need to really understand what that means, because I think sometimes we in this country believe, oh, that's not going to impact me. This is a problem that's out there in the world that's influencing or shaping the lives of people who look different than me. But what I found looking at our death ledger, that's not true. All of us are in this death ledger. And it doesn't matter if you're white or you're Republican or Muslim or Arab or non-binary or mixed race, law enforcement violence targets us all. So I think what the story here is, these systems of violent policing were born to sort of police formerly enslaved people with Hispanic, Latino origins, and non-whites. But these systems evolve over time. And that evolution has been aided by an overinvestment into policing and an underinvestment into people, into the social safety net. And so now we have a system that is incredibly efficient at identifying people who are threats and tragically eliminating those threats. And sometimes that involves losing our lives. And so I think that's the story we need to understand, that we are all vulnerable to this system that is not accountable to the people.
What stands out for you in the untold stories? What incidents stand out for you in the untold stories of people whose deaths have just been swept under the rug? I mean, we remember George Floyd, we remember Breonna Taylor, but those were because of maybe there was either the timing was a certain way, or there was video testimony, or just their loved ones raised enough ruckus to make it a national story. But so many others stay untold, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, I mean, there are, as readers will find when they encounter the book, there are many, many stories in this book. And, you know, some of the stories that have been particularly haunting for me were the ones where the violence was so gratuitous and the victim was so vulnerable. Think about the story of Glenda Raymer, who was a 40-year-old white woman living near Long Beach, who was a disabled woman who had a walker and a cane and also had some mental illness. And she called police in the middle of a crisis, and law enforcement came, and they were very heavy-handed, and suddenly she found herself surrounded by more than 8 police officers and helicopters and patrol cars, and she felt threatened. They shot her at point-blank range with a shotgun with pellets inside, non-lethal round pellets, that ended up actually ending her life instantly. The wound essentially shattered her heart and her ribs. She was weighed less than 100 pounds at the time. And when I read that story and wrote about that story, it was just so clear to me that this is a system that doesn't see the humanity or the vulnerability of people who are in crises. And there are so many cases like this. There are military veterans who are in this book, men who fought wars for the nation and came back home with PTSD and limited access to healthcare and found themselves in crisis. And instead of having institutions of care or a social worker, law enforcement arrived on the scene and ended up taking people's lives. And so I think these are the kinds of things that are happening, and they're often not spoken about in media. They're not spoken about in ways that I think would help us better understand just how widespread and how often these deaths happen. Just to remind your listeners, the way I think about it is that 5 people every day will die in police custody, either during arrest or in jail, but we're only going to know the names of 3 of those people. And that's because the system's designed to report deaths in custody rely on police. We rely on police to tell us the names of the people that they kill. And you can see that there's clearly a conflict of interest right there. And that system has to change.
Have any coroners ever been held accountable specifically for, you know, covering up deaths, for writing death reports in such a way that completely lets police off the hook? I imagine that they're basically part of the blue wall of silence, even if they aren't on the streets wearing badges and wielding guns, that they feel this allegiance to police because they're part of that system. Have any of them individually ever been held accountable? We know that police are only now just barely sometimes getting held accountable by the same system that they're a part of. So has that happened for coroners? And did you get a chance to speak with or interview any coroners or, you know, currently or retired?
You know, the state of Maryland just completed a review of all of the death records written by former medical examiner David Fowler, who was also on the witness stand in the Derek Chauvin case and said some pretty horrible things about George Floyd that really raised suspicions about whether or not the death records he oversaw in the state of Maryland could actually be trusted. And so he is a recent person that has come under the sort of scrutiny of the public and elected officials. When I spoke to medical examiners and coroners around the country, there were many who didn't want to go on the record, but who told me off the record a couple of things that shows a level of complexity. One, many felt pressured and intimidated to write records that were in favor of police and law enforcement. And they often found themselves feeling or caving into this pressure because they didn't always feel that there was a public constituency, members of the concerned community, that would back them up and support them, partly because criminal justice reform movement just hasn't really been focusing on death investigation and death investigators.
My guest has been Terrence Keel. He's a professor of human biology and society and African-American studies at UCLA, and we've been discussing his new book, The Coroner's Silence, Death Records and the Hidden Victims of Police Violence. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
Hi, this is David Barsamyan of Alternative Radio, inviting you to tune in on Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. to hear information, analyses, and views that are frequently ignored or distorted in corporate media. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesdays 2 to 3 p.m., right here on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and online at kpfk.org.
Give a gift to KPFK and yourself when you let us take your unwanted vehicle off your hands. Not only will your donation help support the on-air programs our community relies on every day, but you even qualify for a tax deduction. Go to KPFK.org.